Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome to the program. I'm going to take a little detour from a lot of the things I talk about, and I'm going to talk about my wife's garden and my wife's gardening. From a few potted plants on the back of our townhouse when we were first married, to a rented plot that she ended up expanding and renting a plot nearby where she would go over, to this big garden that's now on our property, my wife gardens. And, you know, she's really into it. I mean, she's got books, shelves of books on gardening, and there's all these tools and all this stuff that are in the garage, and she's getting this thing and that thing and all that stuff and the books and everything with all her gardening stuff. And, you know, in the end, I'm really happy for her indulgence. I'm glad she likes to garden. I just have one request, and only one request. I don't mind paying for it. I don't mind her buying what she needs. The only thing I ask is, don't make me work in the garden myself. Ugh! I mean, I hate gardening. I hate it. You know, you get the dirt and the heat and the bugs and you're in there, you know, the sweat, and you put all this work in a garden, and you put all this stuff to grow this stuff, and what happens? Some rabbit comes, or a deer comes, or some blight comes and takes it away. I mean, I'd rather have a colonoscopy than work in a garden. Now, however much I hate the verb gardening, I love the noun, the garden. And I do like the garden. You know, I do like my wife's garden. And it's beautiful. And I like to walk in it. Just as long as I don't have to work in it. And the other morning, I was in the garden. And I saw some flower. And I don't know. I mean, to me, if it's not a rose, if it's not a sunflower, I'm clueless. I don't know what it is. I don't have any interest in any of that. But I remember it was this flower. And there were these five petals came up, and they were deep purple and scarlet, and they kind of opened up into this burst of color. It's just like petals just dropped down in these outrageously rich colors. And then out of the center, these white stems rose, these like little white things, very thin and very delicate, but just beautiful white. And then on the top, they were crowned. Each one was crowned with like a little crown of something. I don't know what it was. And I stopped and I looked at that flower. I mean, it was beautiful. It just the sheer beauty of the thing, it just captivated me. And in a sense, it was beautiful, but it was almost audacious in the beauty. It was just the audacity of it all. And as I looked at that flower, it almost seemed like it was mocking me. It was sticking out its five lascivious tongues, and it was said something to me. It said, "Come on, Cliff," using logic, using reason, using science to try to understand me. You know, it would be like using paint chemistry, studying paint chemistry to analyze the power and beauty of a Van Gogh painting. All right. So maybe it didn't quite say something, quite say that. But almost. It almost said it to me. And why not? You know, as Adventists, we can be so logical. We can be so rational. We can be so formulaic in our faith. You know, we have this metaphysical cosmic view, the great controversy, in which all the various strands and all the various pieces and all the various threads and particles of our belief system fit quite nicely. In fact, I don't know how Christianity could even possibly work without the great controversy scenario. It makes an incredible amount of sense. You know, I have, for years, I've been an avid fan of the Teaching Company. It's some company, the guy goes around the United States and he goes to different colleges. And they try to ferret out the best teachers, the best teachers at different American universities, you know, and they bring these teachers to the Washington, D.C. area and have them lecture, whether it's philosophy, whether it's science, whether it's literature, history. It's called the Teaching Company, teach12.com. Excellent stuff. And they got stuff, philosophy, religion, and on and on and on. And I've been listening to them in my car now for 12, 13 years. And a while back, I got I listened to a series called The Philosophy of Religion. And it was a fellow named James Hall, I believe his name is, teaches at the University of Religion. And Dr. Hall describes himself as, quote, an agnostic Episcopalian. Okay, all right, don't shoot this me. I just said what he said. That's what he called himself, an agnostic Episcopalian. But anyway, Hall does this, I think, 38 lectures on the philosophy of religion. Some of the stuff was very good. He was very fair. I disagreed with a lot of what he said, which just shows, again, how, you know, your premises can lead you to different conclusions. But considering his premises and so forth, I thought he was very fair, and I appreciated that. Now, Hall had, about four or five lectures on a theme called theodicy. Now, that's kind of a fancy theological word, theodicy. It's from the Greek word theos, which means God, and dike, means justification. And it talks about the justification of God in the face of evil. In other words, it's the age-old question, if God is all-loving, God is all-powerful, God is all-knowing, why is there so much pain and suffering? And a theodicy attempts to answer this in a clear, logical manner. Because it's, admittedly, it's a very difficult question for those who believe in the God of the Bible, the Judeo-Christian God of Scripture. Well, Hall spends about four or five lectures on theodicy, looking at various theodicies and different attempts to explain the goodness and love and mercy, you know, of God in light of, you know, floods and plagues and fires, which people are killed and, you know, and innocent children die, all the stuff that bothers everybody about the world, but which does seem to present somewhat of a philosophical conundrum to those who believe in an all-loving God. I mean, if you don't believe in God and you don't believe we're here purely by chance, then sure, they're difficult, but that's just what it means to live in a godless, meaningless universe. People suffer for no reason and die, and that's just it. Get with the program. Well, anyway, Hall goes through these various theodicies, explains them, I think, fairly, and he ends each one basically saying, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And I had to agree. Each one he presented didn't work. Didn't work. I mean, I had to agree. He was right. It doesn't explain everything. Then, as he's getting done with that section, he says, oh, yes. He says, there's one more theodicy. One more theodicy. And he goes, nobody takes it seriously today. And then in about 2 minutes' time, this guy basically describes the great controversy scenario. I think he called this theodicy the cosmic free will theodicy. And in it, he talks about how there was this fault, this being, Lucifer, created free, who had free will, and this being chose, for whatever reason, he chose to, you know, rebel against God using his free will, and he fell and he caused a rebellion in heaven. And these angels were kicked down to the earth, where they continued their rebellion on earth, and they led man and Adam and Eve into sin, and that there's this battle going on earth between good and evil, between Christ and Satan, and on and on. I mean, basically, in about 2 minutes, this man describes our understanding of the great controversy between Christ and Satan, the great controversy between good and evil. And again, as I said, he kind of mocked it. He's basically, nobody takes it seriously. But here's the punchline. Here's the point that I don't want to miss. You miss. He describes this sin. Again, he described four or five theodicies, said why none of them worked. Then he describes the great controversy. And then he says, this is the only theodicy that works. Okay? You got a man who's a self-described agnostic Episcopalian. See, if I said it, I mean, I'm in a sense, I'm paid to say that it works, okay? I'm paid to do that. You got a guy here, an agnostic Episcopalian, who looks at our scenario and says it's the only one that works. And yes, it does work, because again, it's logical, it fits together. You know, we even have in our faith some math. We've got data and charts. We've got a prophetic calculus to back up our claims. And they work quite well. They certainly work quite better than most other things I've seen. Have you ever read some of the ways folks speculate about the secret rapture? I mean, they still believe the secret, one day we're going to be, you're going to be here, and all of a sudden people are just going to disappear. They're just going to vanish. You'll be driving along in a car and somebody next to you is going to vanish, and they're taking off at a secret rapture to heaven while we're left. I remember a book came out a number of years ago called 88 Reasons for the Rapture in 1988. Well, you know, while we're 2008 and going beyond, so maybe it'll have 209 reasons for the rapture in 2009. Now, I recently read of a website where they say you send them $40. You send them $40. They got a plan so that if you're secretly raptured, I mean, you just zap. God just takes you up to heaven like that. You can contact your left behind relatives. And you can let them know that you're all right and so on and so forth and give them a chance to try to be saved too or whatever. Don't ask me, well, I think the idea, the way this program how it works is supposedly certain members of their team whom they assume are going to be raptured, if they don't log on to their computers or whatever, then the computers automatically will send messages to your relatives, give them your assets, send them your warnings, last chance to be saved. I mean, come on, folks. Come on, folks. No, I think our views about end time events work much, much better than something like that. And that's fine. Our beliefs need to make sense. But we must be careful. We mustn't dupe ourselves into thinking that we've got it all figured out. Or that it even can all be figured out. You know, I've stood before these cameras before, and I've talked about some of the incredible paradoxes and just baffling challenges of reality itself. I've talked here about quantum physics a little bit and how these subatomic particles, they don't really exist until we look at them. A lot of them, you know, these particles exist as a probability wave, a wave which expands really ideally through all the universe. And then when you look at it, the wave function collapses and it collapses into a particle that we understand as particles. I mean, this happens out there. They don't know why. Or I talk about how particles know that they're being measured. They know when you're looking at them and they react differently. I mean, these things aren't speculative. It happens. What we have no idea is how it happens. And I guess the point of that, as I'm saying, is that reality itself so far baffles even the most simple things. Have things that we don't understand. I talked to about Einstein's relativity and space and time are changing, and that gravity is just mass, you know, bending space and time. Yes, you know, mass bends time, and the stronger the pull of gravity, the slower time goes. How do we wrap our mind? We don't even begin to understand these things. So you've got all this stuff, and then you've got that outrageous flower in my wife's garden. You see, God has created a universe far too grand to be grasped by something as parochial and limited, as contingent as human reason, even reason founded on revelation. You know, I don't know how many of you have ever read Leo Tolstoy, Count Leo Tolstoy, the great Russian writer. And, oh, great writer, great stuff. Ah, oh, his books are fabulous. War and Peace, Anna Karenina. And he's got a great short stories. And he wrote a book called Confessions. And Tolstoy went through quite a bit of religious struggles in his own life. And here was a man who made it to the top. He came from a wealthy family. He was one of the most famous writers in the world. I mean, he was almost a god in Russia. at the time. You know, had everything that you could think the world would want. And yet as he got older, he felt like his life was meaningless. He had no purpose in life. And in the end, he said that his reason showed him that his life was meaningless and empty and it had no purpose. And ultimately, Tolstoy had to reach out beyond where his reason could take him. He had to reach out in faith and go beyond reason. And you know, there was, again, I come back to my wife's garden, that flower in the garden. Again, there was just something about that flower. Just something about it that it just seemed to enter a dimension where logic is too staid, it's too inflexible to enter. I mean, how can equations, cold, dead, static, you know, define a reality, you know, filled with the kind of passion and creativity that I saw in that flower? What, you know, what algorithm can explain the passion of Shakespeare's King Lear? You know, a dove cooing. How are you going to put that in a mathematical formula? What principles could explain the foreboding and the fear in Van Gogh's famous painting, Wheat Field with Crows? I mean, theories and formulas and principles, they don't make stars burn. They don't make woodpeckers peck. They don't make mother bears feed their cubs. You know, any more than if I carve the letters E equals MC squared into a piece of uranium. If I wrote the formula on the uranium's going to blow up in a chain reactions. You know, it's funny, there's a fella, Hungarian physicist, a chemist who became a philosopher of science named Michael Polanyi. And Polanyi wrote, you know, he wrote that the basis of science to reduce all reality to the movement of subatomic particles is just ridiculous. He says that doesn't answer anything, doesn't tell us anything about reality, about what's really out there. I know many of you ever read Johann Goethe. He wrote Faust and so on, and he wrote this fascinating, fabulous little booklet called The Sorrows of Young Werther. And it's this young guy who's just unrequited love. He falls in love with this girl who's engaged to be married to somebody else. And, you know, he ends up killing himself. And, you know, just it was part of the romantic revolt against sort of that hardcore rationalism of the Enlightenment and so on. But there's a scene in there. There's a scene in there where young Goethe, and he catches something of what I'm trying to say. He says, "Oh, how thankful I am that my heart can feel the simple, harmless joys of the man who brings to the table a head of cabbage he has grown himself, and a single moment enjoys not only the vegetable, but all the fine days and fresh mornings since he planted it. I guess he likes gardening, not me. And all the fresh mornings since he planted it, the mild evenings when he watered it, and the pleasure he felt while watching it grow." Okay, now I admit, getting so rapturous over a head of cabbage, all right, I'll admit it's a bit much. But again, I like the point. And his point is that we're so used to the majesty of creation. We forget what a miracle. We forget what a miracle our existence is. Now, I recently read a book called The Goldilocks Enigma. And again, it's just talking about this, all these anthropic coincidences and how you've got all these things in nature that are so finely tuned. So it's like the universe was set. Imagine a wall with a bunch of dials. And you got 30 dials. And these dials are each one marked off, you know, one of a million. You've got a million different ways you can turn the thing in 360 degrees. And you got these 30. So you got 30 million different things. And if you were to turn one of the dials, even one notch, one bit, the universe as we know it couldn't exist, and humanity as we know it couldn't exist. I mean, it's so powerful. And, you know, some people, one guy said that the universe saw us coming. You know? And now they have all sorts of ways to try to get out of it. They say there's endless number of universes. So if you got a billions of universes or endless number of universes, all these multi-universes, then anything could happen and we just happen to have a universe that has life. It's no big deal. Or some are even speculating that nothing created us. I mean, so eager to try to get around God, they say nothing created us. We just happen to be here. I mean, this is some of the stuff that they're trying to come up with to explain all this. But let's put all that aside. Put all that aside, and let's just come back to that flower. That flower. The beauty of it. Again, just the only word I can use to describe it, it was audacious. Just the colors, the audacity of it, the outrageousness of it all. It just seemed, at that moment, it transcended all theory. It transcended to me all philosophy. It transcended all science. It just pointed me to a realm beyond any of that stuff. I mean, and a plus two, for what it's worth, I gazed at the petals, those petals, and I pitied all Darwinists. I mean, come on, to think that evolved by chance, by chance. Oh, I could so agree. I can so agree with the words in Scripture where Paul talks about, you know, how foolish the wisdom of the world is. It looks at itself, and with all its theories and presupposition, it replaces the obvious with the absurd. I don't know, I might have even mentioned this on this show one time, but it's a great example. It's a great example of how the outrageousness things that people will go to try to get away from the obvious. There was this book, Bill Bryson, he wrote a book called The Short History of Nearly Everything. And he tries to give the following explanation for a godless creation. No God, we just happen to be here. And this is what he says. Think of this logic here. It seems impossible that you could get something from nothing. But the fact that once there was nothing, but now there is a universe, is evident proof that you can. Okay? How's that for logic and reason? Let me run this by you again, okay? This is trying to explain the universe without God. Okay? He goes, it seems impossible that you could get something from nothing. But the fact that once there was nothing, but now there is a universe, is evident proof that you can. Voila! That guy, he nailed it down, man. That's logic. How's that for logic and reason? This isn't science. This isn't logic. This isn't reason. It's absurdity passing itself off as cosmology. Talk about having a few unsupported presuppositions. Talk about a surrender of rationality itself. Yeah. I think the wisdom of the world is pretty foolish in contrast to the wisdom of God. You know, I read a book a while back by a fellow named Richard Tarnas. I think I'd mentioned this book here before. It was a book kind of impacted my life in a big way, even though it was kind of nonsensical. And he looked around the size of the universe. And as science was, the telescopes were getting us further and further out into the universe, and we were understanding the size of the universe and how little our little planet was in contrast to the universe. And then he talked about what he called the sheer implausibility of it all, meaning the whole Christian story, the whole idea that, you know, that God would come down in humanity and have this one life living in some backwater, you know, thousands of years ago, that this one life could have cosmic implications and so on. He talked about, I think the quote he used was the sheer implausibility of it all. But again, that's the problem. He was limiting his worldview to logic and reason alone. He was trying to use logic and reason to explain that flower. And I would agree, the love of God and God's love for us is way too great, is way too great for us to ever grasp rationally alone. I like these words of Paul in the book of Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 1, 18 through 27. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. Noticing foolishness. Then he goes on and on and on. Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did know not God, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached, you know, to save those who believe. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews, and foolishness. Again, he uses the word foolishness. To the Gentiles. Then he goes on, for the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom. And the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. Then he ends, but God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. Foolishness. That's the word he uses over and over. The foolishness of the world. The foolishness of our world. And I think if you look around at some of the foolish things people believe and teach, shows how true those words are. And in a sense, that flower, coming back to that flower in my wise garden, I looked at that flower, and in a sense, that flower makes fools of us. Some people can look at that flower and declare, backed by scientific proofs, formulas, and theories, all peer-reviewed too, mind you, that it was an accident, that it wasn't designed, that it exists by chance. That's the overarching paradigm for today. That's what they'll tell you. It was by chance. It's there purely just give us enough time, and inevitably that beautiful flower is going to appear. Me, I looked at that flower and saw, besides my own ignorance, undeniable evidence of God's love. Something in that flower gave me a young Werthian sense of the divine. Something beyond words. Something beyond explanation. And so, in a sense, maybe it's cheating a little. But it was something beyond refute. I saw it all there in that flower. I mean, there's no question. So I said, I love my wife's garden. As I said, though, just as long as you don't make me work in it. But in that flower in the garden, I saw some important truths about the limits of what we could ever think through ourselves. We got to go beyond where logic can take us. Think about it.